I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Tonight, I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young.
Colleen Kettenhoffen with us. She's the author of Secrets Your Boss Isn't Telling You, How to Advance Your Career, Increase Your Productivity, and Have More Fun at the Workplace. She's interviewed more than 200 managers and a handful of CEOs. She's an international workplace employee and management expert, corporate speaker, and a career turnaround specialist, a media veteran, and she's appeared on numerous radio shows around the country and has written more than 40 articles on the diverse workplace issues. And again, she's the author of 10 audio programs and 2 books, and again, including Secrets Your Boss Isn't Telling You. Colleen, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Oh, I am. I'm better than good, and thank you so much for being here. And I think the topic in and of itself today, with all the problems with the high unemployment rate and so on and so forth, people staying at a job today has got to be tougher than it was. And Colleen, I've got to tell you, I would probably go crazy being a boss, because there's two words that you use that really says almost the entire problem. It's called workplace culture. There's so many different people that apply for jobs that are working today that they're different age groups, different cultures. They don't think the same. And their language, it's almost as if they speak different languages at work.
Yes, that's really true. You know, it's really a matter of managing and I think working in and around multicultural teams, you really kind of have to know who you're talking to and who you're working with and what your boss's expectations are, because it probably has changed a lot. I know when I went to your website, it mentioned you're a former owner of many successful businesses, so I'm sure you've been in the management role many times.
Oh, many, many. You know, and I've done consultant work, you know, for many, many years now with different businesses. And one of the things that I find, you take the word multiculture. If we hear that word, we want to define it as, you know, different ethnicities, different this, different that. But a multiculture are people that we have right here in this country, different age groups that speak the English language and yet have different definitions of how they go about their life. I think that in and itself has got to be one of the hardest things to move through and get over with.
The generations is a really big one right now when I do management skills training.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's no question about it, because kids today weren't brought up the way I was brought up. And I'm not going to tell you that I'm dead before 1946. That's a secret. Nobody knows that.
Well, it's interesting, because when I have young people in my seminars, they're engaged, they're energetic, they ask good questions, they offer good information. So the ones that I have, the millennials, the, you know, Generation Y, typically born after 1981, they're terrific, especially if they're managers or supervisors or team leads, which most of them are. But also in my leadership programs, I will say that one of the biggest complaints that I get from managers and supervisors, and even from coworkers, is if they're supervising the youngest generation right out of school, because the phrase that they all use is sense of entitlement. They feel like they have a sense of entitlement. And maybe now in this economy, that's changing with people worried about losing their jobs.
No, absolutely. And the entitlement thing, I'd say the last 5, 6, 7 years, has been going on, and it's predominantly in the workplace today. The relationship between the boss and the employee is completely different than it was 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago. The other thing to add to the mix, where there's a tremendous amount of confusion, is the high technology, the texting and the cell phones and so on and so forth. The other thing on the good, the other part of that that's the good side, that facet, is that it used to be you got to work at 9 o'clock, you left at 5 o'clock, you had lunch, you know, you did your 8 hours. But today, you could literally sit out on the beach, get a tan, and accomplish everything out of a BlackBerry.
Yes, That's really true. Uh-huh. So it's a good thing and a bad thing, because you can be away from work and still be doing your work. And on the flip side, you can be on vacation and everybody still has a way of getting a hold of you. So that's what I hear a lot of people say. They just feel like they're on information overload because a vacation isn't, you know, a real vacation anymore. They can fax you and email you. And you'd be surprised, Michael. One of the things I'm starting to hear about a lot is managers and even employees. You know, this is probably something that your listeners are familiar with, where if somebody is angry with their coworker or their boss, they're going on social media sites like Facebook, and in the update, status update, they're mentioning that person by name and what they did, and that's happening a lot.
No, and by the way, when we really look at this, how do you stop, rhetorically, how do you stop something like that? You're an employer, and your employee does something like that on Facebook. The employee comes in the next day, and you say you're fired. Guess what? You get to get sued. You know, so it's a really sticky, I lost the word I want to use, situation that you can get in today. It's not as easy as sitting down with somebody and saying, here's the problem, and you don't do that. There's that, I think it's that entitlement thing. I think bosses today are frightened to death of their employees. If they're not, they don't handle them correctly, they could end up in jail.
Yes, absolutely. There are some bosses who are definitely afraid of the employees, especially if the worker has their attorney calling up and threatening and saying, you're creating a hostile, threatening environment. And probably the biggest challenge that I see for managers and supervisors as I go around the country and I do leadership training is, and I think your listeners can probably think of bosses who are like this, or this might have been them, if they were a new manager at one point, and that is many managers and supervisors are promoted to leadership positions based on their hard skills or an outstanding job in a previous position, but most of them have never had management skills training or people skills in terms of how to handle a difficult employee. So if they don't nip it in the bud early on, not only does it become more difficult for them because now their human resources department, or if it goes to court, will say, well, you know, why did you not bring up this issue for 2 months? Why was it not important enough that you brought it up? And then why after 2 months did you suddenly bring it up? Why was it suddenly so important? So managers can be seen as enabling the behavior. So there's that fine line in, as you said, they don't want to be sued. And at the same time, you know, don't let the inmates run the insane asylum, because it's so much harder for the other workers, too. They're the ones that have to deal with this difficult coworker if their boss doesn't do anything about it. And based on all my research for the book, I found that a lot of people said to me, you know, it really starts to be a negative reflection after a while on the boss, because people start to wonder, why is he or she not doing anything about it? So it starts to reflect more negatively on them as opposed to the employee after you know, a period of time.
Sure, you brought up an interesting point, and I really believe that this is the heart of a lot of it. You're familiar with the Peter Principle, the height of incompetence. Mm-hmm. You got somebody who's a great salesperson, and because they are, they put them up in the management. So they're a great salesperson, they're an okay manager. Now they've been there long enough, they become a supervisor. Now they're the great salesperson, okay manager, and a lousy supervisor. And along the way, no one taught them how to be a leader. No one taught them the skills of communication that'll connect with that employee to get what they want when they want a job done. And the days of, I don't like you, go find another job, are over with. I think it's dangerous to fire somebody.
It is. I mean, I have a lot of bosses who privately will say to me, you know, I've got this employee and they're in a protected class And, you know, protected class for your listeners who don't know, that would be issues like gender, race, age, somebody who's over 40, somebody who has a handicap. A lot of managers will whisper to me privately that if they have somebody like that, they're afraid to fire them because the employee has said, well, you just want to fire me because I'm such and such. You know, that's the only reason. And the manager will say to me, look, I really have a good reason. You know, typically the reason is this person is just not doing their job, or they're what I call a high performer, high maintenance employee. They're doing their job, but in some way they're wreaking havoc on everybody else. They're either a chronic complainer or the gossip, or they talk about their personal life all day, every day, and or also I call them the pot stirrers, the people that have that desire for dissension. So now the manager's afraid, and then people such as some of your listeners, they've got to deal with this person. If they're not the boss, if they are the manager, they really have to do something about it, because otherwise it gives this person all the control.
And then there's another problem that comes up, and now I'm going to go back to communication again. And I've gone through this time and again. I'll walk into a CEO, CFO, and I'll say, okay, your immediate subordinate, whatever management capacity they're in, write down what you think their job is. And then I'll go to that person. I'll say, write down what you think your job is. 9 out of 10 times, Colleen, it's never the same thing. And I think that in and of itself is a tremendous problem in the workplace. Nobody knows what they're really supposed to do. And if I think you're supposed to do something and you think you're supposed to do something else, I'm always mad at you.
You know what? That is so true. And I tell people this, that when I'm talking to managers and supervisors, I'll say one of the main reasons why employees don't perform up to standards is because their goals and roles and objectives aren't clear enough. And just as you said, Michael, if you were to have employees sit down and write what they think are their top priorities, and their bosses were to write down what they think that employee's top priorities are, so many of them would not match up. And anybody listening is probably thinking, but isn't this basic, you know, that there's got to be a lot of communication between the manager and the employee. Isn't that just common sense? And it is, but as you know, common sense isn't always commonly applied.
No, I think common sense in the workplace anymore, unless you've established it, unless you've set the ground rules, it's not there. And I'm going to go back to the cultural communication, the difference between the age groups and how to treat them, quote unquote. We've got a tremendous amount of youngsters going on into the job market today that feel completely different than somebody that went on 5-10 years ago. The culture, I'm going to use that word again, the culture is so different, and the definitions of what it's supposed to mean is completely different. So people in the job, quote unquote, industry today, you got a tough time. So here's the big question. How do you walk in and mediate in a case like that we were talking about? Somebody says, you can't fire me. You don't like me because I'm a color, I'm a gender, I'm an ethnicity, I'm a something. And you know they're using it as a tool, as a weapon to protect themselves. And at the same time, how do you say you're not without getting sued? You've got to you've got to have a really tough job.
It is a tough job, and this is where you've got to have the leadership training so that you know what to say, what not to say, and how to say it. It's really important for people in a leadership position to stick to the facts rather than saying, for example, John, you've been late the last 3 days, and it's as if you're expecting everybody else to do your work. That's too subjective, and as you know, Michael, you can't try and get into their mind, even if you know that maybe that's what they're really doing. But what you have to say is, for example, John, I noticed that on Monday, November 21st, you came in at 8:30 instead of 8 o'clock. I noticed it happened again on Wednesday, November 23rd, where once again you came in at 8:25 instead of 8 o'clock. What seems to be the cause of this? So you're asking an open-ended question why this behavior is happening, but you're focused on the facts and you're focused on the behaviors and whatever it is that they are not doing or supposed to be doing. You really have to remain objective, not subjective, and documentation is more important than ever. I've written a lot of articles which are on my website, and in one of the articles I said, as far as the courts are concerned, if it's not written down, it's as if it didn't happen.
No, actually, and when we look at it, let's add something to the mix. When you sit down with somebody, make sure you have a witness, you've got a tape recorded, and you have it, and you've got a film of it anymore, because it.
You really do. Yeah, you've got to have a witness, because otherwise that person could say, "Well, I never signed anything because I was never talked to about this. I was never warned." And so you're absolutely right. If you have somebody there, like an HR person, human resources, or another manager, then you've got that person to say, no, Michael did have the meeting with this employee. He did explain that this was a, you know, verbal warning or whatever, and this employee just refused to sign. Even when Michael told him, look, you're not signing because you agree, I know you've said you're upset and you don't agree, it's just to show and acknowledge that the meeting took place. And sometimes even then they don't sign, and so of course you have to document that. But you're right, you definitely need a witness. The people that really have it the toughest is people who work for the government or who supervise union employees, because typically what I hear from my seminar attendees, even people that I interviewed for the book, managers and supervisors on airplanes, if you're supervising government or union employees, it can take a year and a half to 5 years of documentation.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and Colleen, we're starting to run out of time, but one of the most important things is it's too bad that we even have to discuss this issue in the first place.
But it's happening. Exactly.
And thank goodness there's people like yourself out there that basically know what to do and how to mediate it and how to put it back together again, because there's a lot of people out there who just put everything they have into the new career that they've got, the new business, the entrepreneurs, and somebody who doesn't care can walk in within a very short period of time and destroy the entire thing because of who said what, and they did that to me.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Website, we can find you, find the book, and the blogs.
Okay, the website is bounceback hire.com. Bounce back hire, spelled HIGHER.com, is in bounce back hire from adversity. And we've got a lot of articles on there that your listeners can read and print out. We've got CDs, audios, and of course my book, Secrets Your Boss Isn't Telling You, where we go into detail on bosses' top 10 biggest pet peeves that you should avoid at all costs. And also in the book, what are the top 10 things you need to know or do to keep your boss happy and hopefully keep your job?
Oh, I hear that one. Colleen, hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Michael, for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Happy Thanksgiving. Bye-bye.
Oh, you too. Bye-bye.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see.
When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Joshua Glenn with us, Boston-based writer and editor and semiotics analyst, and he's a co-author with Mark Kingwell of the Wage Slave's Glossary and its prequel, The Idler's Glossary. And let's say, Joshua, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we deal with a glossary, you know, usually we're talking about definitions of words, and every place that we go, it seems as though, whether it's the workplace, whether you go to the doctor's office, wherever it is, everything has its own management. And everything has its own communication, its own language, its own definitions. And if you don't know it, you get into trouble very rapidly. So when we are dealing with the job market today, when you guys look at it, what do you see as the major problem that we're facing?
Well, mainstream economists suggest that boosting productivity and creating more jobs are the only solutions to, you know, the problems that are facing American workers.
Yeah.
Mark and I are saying that the work system as we know it is broken, and we don't have a 10-point plan to fix it. We don't have a Republican or Democratic or Marxist or capitalist fix for all this. We're just asking people to rethink their ideas about life and to ask themselves whether they were put on this planet to be bossed around by a manager. We're asking, is work our natural condition? And the way into that, you know, there's many ways you could approach that, but our way is through a glossary, because we feel that ideas creep into consciousness and are made to seem natural and eternal. They become common sense via language. The way we think and the words we use to express ourselves are inextricable. The values of work are dominant in all of life, and they're expressed in the words that we use. So we thought that by taking a look at, you know, workplace jargon, management speak, and also some kind of obsolete notions about work, we might shed some light on the way that we think about work and what it means today.
You know, interesting point. I think one of the biggest problems, Joshua, that you guys would have, or anybody would have, that took to task what you did, would be, and we just finished an interview about it, on the workplace, the different cultures that you're dealing with. I didn't say what I did in the last interview, but when you deal with multiculturalism, you would think you'd be dealing with different ethnicities, etc. But that's not so. Multiculturalism is every 5 or 6 years there's another group of kids that are born right here in the United States that are brought up differently in a different culture. They think differently. And when you get it all together in the workplace, man, has that got to be a disaster.
Yeah, some of the words we look at are very much critical of, you know, workers who are now in their 20s. For example, there's a word floating around in American workplaces now called a phrase called done, which it refers to the fact that supposedly a lot of young workers say that they're done with a job when they're not actually done. And the theory is this is because they've been told their whole life how great they are and how everything they do is perfect, whether or not it's actually perfect. So they turn in a project thinking that it's done, and then it's not done. So then they have to make it be done, meaning actually done.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, there's other phrases about the same generation, the slackwazee, for example, the idea that kids, workers of this age in their 20s, feel like they're too good for their jobs, and they want to advance very quickly, and they don't want to have to do kind of work their way up from the bottom like other people had to in the past. However, I have to say, although I'm, you know, an older worker myself, I'm 44, I have a lot of sympathy for this position. I do think that most of us are too good for our jobs, and it's great that there's an entire generation who feels that way.
You know, then that's interesting also when we talk about, you know, feeling too good for the job, quote-unquote. the purpose of the job, for the most part, is to put food on the table. You got to get paid, otherwise you're not going to be able to function as a viable human being today, you know, with or without the job. And one of the things that the generation that I came from was that if you have a job, you did what the boss told you to do. There, I think, is where the problem is. If you're going to accept a job, you should accept the guidelines, you in the general sense of the word, you should accept the guidelines of the job, and you follow the rules. You break the rules, you're out. But it doesn't work that way anymore.
Well, Michael, you're a serial entrepreneur. You've owned a lot of businesses, so you're more of the kind of person who doesn't like to follow the rules and have other people tell you what to do, it would seem to me. I think that whether we're blue or white collar or labor or management, 99% of us, as the Occupy Wall Street movement would say, are deprived every day of the opportunity to conceive of ourselves as, you know, deciders of our own actions. In the workplace, we're told not only what to do, but how and when to do it. And what's worse, we don't realize that is not a state of being free. We're told that we're free to make our choices in this country, and that we're free to move around from job to job and take a different job. But the fact is, the current work system is the only system we've ever known, and most of us buy into the idea that if you resist or reject that work system, you're some kind of slacker or loser or failure. And what we're interested in is looking back in history at the early 19th century, back to a time when the United States was transitioning from a kind of a society where everybody was like you. Everybody was kind of an independent worker, a freeholder, a yeoman farmer, an artisan who could make their own decisions about the work process. They decided how they were going to do the work. They decided when they were going to do the work. Therefore, the work had a lot of meaning to them, and it felt very gratifying at the end of the day. And we transitioned in the early 19th century to this industrial work system, where, you know, everybody basically, you were told that you were free to be as a worker, and yet, in fact, you were to the artisan type or the yeoman farmer type, you looked more like a servant. You were being told what to do and how to do it and when to do it. And that was a very uncomfortable period for the early 19th century, and there was a lot of language that comes out of that period that we look at that expresses the fact that people were, you know, concerned that we were moving from a nation of independent types to a nation of basically servants or even slaves who didn't know that they were servants or slaves.
Okay, Joshua, let's go back to 1961. In 1961, I worked for, we don't tell anybody about this, our secret. In 1961, I worked for a place called Norris Thermidor Corporation, and it was in Southern California, Los Angeles area. And I got paid, I think it was $1.65 an hour. And what I did all day long, the wheels would come off of this, the wheels would come off of this this belt, and I would take the wheel off the belt and I stick it on a pallet. Then they come over and they pick it up. Now, 8 hours a day, I did that, but they paid me to do that. That's what I was supposed to do. Now, with all due respect to what you're saying, we're not going to battle back and forth about it. But when if you have a job to offer someone, you offer them the job and you say, this is what we need to be done. If you're willing to do the job, you get paid for it, so you're not a slave. You're accepting something for doing that job. But when we come down to it, you can't walk into a place and say, I'm going to do it the way I want to do it, and that's the end of it, and I'll make my decisions, if you're going to be the one who's accepting the money. There's where I think a problem is.
I agree that is exactly how it is, and I've had plenty of jobs myself.
Sure.
I was a good worker. I was a hard worker, but I think it's unfortunate that it's that way. And I think that once upon a time it wasn't that way, and I hope that in the future it could be a different way. I think that we were all put on this planet to work for ourselves, basically, to do, you know, not to sit around and eat grapes all day long and, live off the fat of the land. I realize that that's impossible, and I don't think capitalism is going away. I'm not making any kind of utopian claims like that. I just feel that the way the work system is set up has come into being over time, and it seems very natural and permanent and inevitable now, but I don't think that it really is. I think there was once upon a time when not everybody, you know, basically worked as a servant, renting out themselves and their time to somebody else and being told how to do their work in exchange for money. Now, I realize this system has been in place for a long time, and we all get pride out of that now, where we can get it. And especially in a time right now of economic crisis, when people are very anxious and jobs are scarce and we want one really badly, we're even less likely to kind of criticize the system as a whole. But I think this is actually a really good time to criticize the system, because maybe we can start thinking of ways to, you know, let all of us have the kind of freedom that once upon a time an artisan or a yeoman farmer had.
Okay, but how do you do that? And this is an honest question. You got something that you have to mass produce something. Let's say, for instance, the auto industry. You have to have workers that do certain pieces and parts to put that automobile together. So at the end of the day, you've got something that's completed and it's going to drive off. How do you walk in there and do it the way you want to and do it yourself and have total freedom if you've got to go step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to get what you want at the end of the day? That's where I'm confused. That's where I'm a little bit lost with your subject matter.
Well, within the system as we have it now, at the very least, you could give workers more control over their decision-making processes. You know, when workers, and the Japanese have done this, and in fact, American, business consultants went over to Japan after World War II and taught them how to do this, and then they sold it, the idea back to us. But in fact, if you listen to workers, they will make great improvements all the time. One thing that since the Industrial Revolution convinced us of was that only managers can make good decisions about the work process. Managers should decide everything, and workers should just do what the managers say. But I think that one thing we've learned from Japan and that we actually have instituted in this country is the idea that workers have good ideas too, but they're the ones actually doing the work. And the more that they're allowed to make decisions about how and when they do their work, not only is it does that work become more meaningful and less alienating to them, but it actually can be more efficient, and you can actually get those cars made and those wheels put on the axles.
Okay, but how do you do, in a practical level, let's pick a job, let's pick an industry, and based on what you're talking about, the philosophy of what you're of living a life during, you know, doing business, having a job, what do you do to do that? Because I think before you can do anything, you got to be able to have an example to get your arms around.
Well, you know, I wrote a glossary. I'm not a management consultant. I wrote a book about language. However, to answer your question, what I'm trying to say is, you know, workplace democracy. You know, listening to the worker, giving workers more control over what they do. That's my answer. I mean, I worked at the Boston Globe as a journalist for several years, and where we both had, you know, the journalists in one room, and then right next door we had the printing presses, and to me, it always seemed like the more you asked the workers, whether they're running the presses or reporting the stories, how to improve their processes and how to be more efficient and how to do a better job and how to sell a better product, the better the product became, the more efficient things became. So in some ways, I'm just suggesting that if we just listen to workers more and give them more freedom, we're getting closer to this kind of ideal model that I have in mind. That seems fairly concrete to me.
Okay, now the ideal model, do we have the ability to do that? And when I say the ability to do that, we live in a country right now where there's so much confusion that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. And I'm not talking about just governing business in general. You've got all of this confusion going on. And let's say I own a business and I want a particular thing done at the end of the day. How do I guarantee that it's going to get done? How do I move through this process with all the employees to say, okay, at the end of the day, ABC has to be done so we can have this work? How do I get them to do that if somebody decides that they don't want to do it? Do I not? And if I don't pay them, I'm going to get sued.
Well, again, I'm the author of a glossary about language. I'm not a consultant. So these are good questions you're asking me. I don't know if I have the answers exactly. However, very, very innovative, creative, imaginative, and hardworking people, right? I think we can agree on that.
Yeah.
Once upon a time, we had a very different system of work. The day-to-day life of your average worker in 1810 was incredibly different than it is today. And thanks to imagination and hard work and having big visions, we changed that dramatically. We invented industrialization. We invented automation, you know what I mean? And we've moved on since, you know, there's been another revolution since then, to, you know, have things become more digital and more virtual and people be able to work in the cloud and so forth. It's incredible the changes that we've made. So I do believe that whatever it is that our vision is going to be should not be held back by the fact that we think it's too out there, it's too weird, it's too different and new. Because we have in the past, you know, made these tremendous changes based on these visions that must have seemed bizarre at the time.
Yeah. Now, by the way, let me tell you the problem you're having with me. And it's very simple. Ask me who I want as president and vice president.
Who do you want as president and vice president?
Funny you should ask that. John Wayne and the Fonz. I mean, that's the world. That's the world I came from. And by the way, I think the glossary in and of itself, I think it's critically important, because if I, Joshua, if I don't know the language, I can't speak it to someone. If I don't know the language, I can't communicate what I want in the workplace. So I think what you're doing is absolutely brilliant. The other concept, the other philosophy may not be very practical at this moment, because we have a lot of people who don't know what they want, and that's scary.
We do. Well, let me talk quickly, since this is a book about language, about a couple of interesting words from the current workplace and their interesting origins. One of the things that in the 1990s, when I was working at .com, I started to hear this a lot, and you still hear it in the workplaces a lot now, is the word bandwidth, used to describe your own ability to get something accomplished because of how much time and energy that you have. So you might say to a colleague, can you get this project to me finished by Friday? And they'll say no, because I don't have enough bandwidth. What's interesting to me is that, you know, that bandwidth refers to, you know, it's a computer thing. It's how much information can come through the pipe, you know, at a time. And it's very interesting to hear workers describe themselves in terms of the machines that they're using. Multitasking is another example, where computers were something that multitasked. And then people started describing themselves as trying to multitask by, as you know, typing while they're talking on the phone and while they're, you know, making a cup of coffee at the same time. And as I started looking into it, I realized that this is just describing ourselves in terms of machinery goes back at least to the early 20th century, when we started using words like downtime, which originally meant the time when a machine was down for servicing, to describe our own, you know, moments of leisure, or even our weekends or summer vacations. That seems to me a little bit telling and weird, and, you know, a sign of something bad in the workplace when we have to describe ourselves in terms of machines. I don't feel like I was put on this planet to be a machine. I'm a human being. So sure. It feels bad to me that I would describe myself as a machine.
You know what? I am so glad that I'm not the boss of a company that has 50 to 100 employees. I would probably go insane working with the philosophy that I have, as opposed to what's new in the marketplace today. But that's okay. We're going to grow. We're going to build. I think that when you really come down to it, Joshua, what you guys have done with the glossary is critical, because if I can't speak your language, we're never going to communicate, and we'll never stay focused and stay on the same path together. So that in and of itself is great. The other 200-300 years from now, we'll sit down and see who was right.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Hey, Joshua, do you have a website we can find you at?
Sure. The book was on Amazon. It's called The Wage Slaves Glossary by Joshua Glenn and Mark Kingwell, published by Biblioasis. And the website is hilobrow.com, hilobrow.com/WSG for Wage Slaves Glossary.
Wonderful. Hey, Joshua, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time. And I think anybody working today, which is a lot of people, should get that glossary so they have a way to connect with those other people that are around.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Okay, take care. Good night.
You too.
Miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you're always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you gon' get it. You know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only,
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Michael Broder with us, and he is the author of Stage Climbing, The Shortest Path to Your Highest Potential. He's a renowned psychologist and executive coach, a best-selling author, continuing education seminar leader, and a public speaker. He's an acclaimed expert in cognitive behavioral therapy, specializing in high achievers and relationship issues. His work centers on bringing about major change in the shortest time possible. Sought-after media guest, he's appeared on Oprah, The Today Show, as well as making more than 1,000 other TV and radio appearances. And let us say, Mike, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Michael. Great to be here.
My absolute pleasure. Stage climbing, the shortest path to your highest potential. Mike, what is it, if you had an overarching theme of all the people you've worked with and the work you've done over the years, what is it that stops people from even looking at that possible potential they have within inside? What scares them?
Well, the biggest thing, reason that they don't look at it isn't necessarily fear. Now, fear comes in a little bit later on, but the saddest thing of all is, Michael, that most people don't realize that it's there. And the first step that I often have to do, and this is one of the reasons that I wrote Stage Climbing, is to show them that there is a zone that they can access for virtually any part of their life, whether it be their career, relationships, their parenting skills, their spirituality, where they are unique and where they can excel. You know, it's interesting, last month or so, and I'm tempted to ask you how many times the name Steve Jobs has come up in one of your interviews.
Quite a few.
And why are we talking about Steve Jobs as much as we are now that he's gone, now that he's not with us anymore? The reason is because he kind of personifies something that a lot of people think is magic. You know, he's been compared to Einstein and Edison and all those people. The fact of the matter is that there really is a Steve Jobs inside every one of us. And I like to tell people that their highest duty to themselves is to discover it. And that's one of the things that I've gotten over the years from working with so many high achievers, whether they be business people or politicians, sports people, entertainers, that These are people who come in not quite to that point yet, but once they are able to be open to entering that zone, incredible things happen.
Mike, I think one of the biggest problems that we have today, and I've seen it over years and years and years, working with people, dealing with people, and just on the air, that most people, from what I have found, there seems to be this one problem that most people have. They're waiting to get permission to be able to experience their full potential, because somewhere in their behavior many years ago, someone said they can't do it, or they're trying to live up to someone else's definition of what perfection is, which they'll never do. And I really believe the first thing we have to do is give ourselves permission to do it. What I'm hearing you say, and I'll paraphrase it, it's not what you don't know, it's what you don't know that you don't know, and once you find out, you're ready to go.
That's right. That's right, and you'll never have it any other way. And by the way, That's a great segue to answer the first question that you asked me, which was, where is the fear? And the fear is of being different, because once you enter that zone, you're in a category by yourself, no matter what that is, whether it be in your field, whether it be in something that you do better than anyone else, or whether it even be in the relationship area of your life. And you're no longer following the rules that don't work for you, that someone else may have set up for you, whether they be tradition or something more explicitly directed to you by your parents, or even by the person you're involved with in a relationship or a marriage. You're essentially following your own rules. You're following your own trail of passion, which is also your trail of joy. And that's the secret to living the life that you were meant to live.
Yeah, and I think one of the most important things, I'm going to come back to this in a different way, it's okay to be you. Once somebody's got that, as simple as that sounds, when they realize that it's okay to be them, there's no stopping them. But they've got to be able to get that first feel, get that whatever that chemical rush is, dopamine or whatever, to say, ah, I can do this. And the moment that that happens, magic occurs. And I call it magic because look what they manifest for themselves when they realize that it's okay to do it and they're going to go out and do it. There's just nothing stands in their way.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And to get there, you need to give up the obsession with what other people think of you, because a lot of people aren't going to, you know, when you travel the road less traveled, there are people who are not going to give you the blanket approval that they may have before.
Yeah.
And it may involve some short-term risks, but once you're there, you'll never turn back. You know, it's very sad. I was just reading a Gallup survey that showed that up to 80% of us do not enjoy our work. And that was one of the saddest things I've read in a long time. There's a lot of sad things out there to read. Because think of how much time you devote to your work. Yet, very few people think of their own passion and their own joy in pursuing that part of their lives, and that's the shift that I'm hoping stage climbing does its job in making.
Now, by the way, there was one problem I would have with the stage climbing process, and I think you'll appreciate this. It's the very beginning. Mm-hmm. It, when it says grow up, I don't know if I can. I'm always going to be 12. But it's so true. We don't grow up. We don't. We stop ourselves from maturing and looking at the world through your own eyes is one thing. But when you get somebody like yourself who has the ability and the experience to, quote unquote, hold me by the hand and take me through it, it's always good to have somebody to look at life through somebody else's eyes, and then you can see what you couldn't see before. And all of a sudden, things do get opened up.
That's right. By the way, growing up also means that you can choose any part of your life that you want to go back to and relive it. You know, being childlike is certainly part of living a very mature life. It's being the master of your choices. And, you know, people have asked me, you know, for over 30 years in my work as a psychologist, well, what's a cure? When are you finished? And of course, the conventional wisdom is, well, you're never finished. We're always growing, and all that. And I subscribed to that for many years, and then all of a sudden it kind of struck me: the cure is when you're the master of your choices.
Yeah.
When you can choose to play like a 4-year-old, and then get back to your adult duties, then you've made it. It's when you're not operating by choice, that's where you have what I call hooks to the lower stages. And the good news is that they can all be removed. You just have to learn how to do it and be committed to leading that life where you're in that zone.
Yeah, that is very interesting when we talk about choice. Choice happens in such strange areas. My sister and my little sister and I got into this major battle a couple of years ago, and I looked at her, and I can't remember the exact words we called each other, but I said, "You loser," and she said something like, "You're nothing more than the dependent on everything." And then we got mad at each other, and I walked out of the room, and then I stopped for a second, and I said, "Ooh, that's interesting. I just called her what I think I am, and she just called me what she thinks she is." And they smiled for a minute and walked back in the room. I said, "You know what just happened?" But the point was, Mike, it was choice. At that moment when I said, "Oh, that's what it was," I chose to go back in and fix it and deal with the real problem, not what the problem looked like.
That's right. That's right. I commend you for that. Couples who can do that have wonderful lives together. And you would not believe what we have to do to get couples to do that quality of thinking together, you know?
But it takes a while to get there. But in relationship, I learned a very powerful lesson years and years ago, and it was this. I actually started out with an interview that I did, and the interview was about a book called The First Kiss. And it got into, you know, the first kiss can make or break a relationship. You know, then none of the guys nobody ever asked the woman they're going to kiss for the first time, "How do you kiss? How do you like to be kissed?" Think about that. Whoever thinks about anything like that? So then I got to thinking about it later on as time went by, and it would be very interesting to wonder how many people in relationships, if you sat down with your significant other and you said to them, "How do you receive love?" We take it for granted that we know, and we don't know. Hypothetically, the way I receive love is a wink, a look, a tone of voice expression, something. Then I meet somebody, and the way she receives love is you buy her something. So we get involved together, and we get into this great relationship. And 2 years go by, and I walk into the house one day, and she's packed up. I said, "Where are you going?" She says, I'm leaving you." "What are you leaving me for?" "You don't love me." I said, "What do you mean I don't love me?" "You never told me. And I've never said it in a way that she had learned to receive it." And I think that is a big hurdle for most people, because you don't sit down and you don't say, "How do you receive it?"
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And one of the reasons that is so prevalent has to do with what you said a little bit earlier, that we too often give what we want rather than what the other person needs. Certainly find that to be the case with sex and marriages and long-term marriages.
Yeah.
Certainly find it to be the case with support, for example, where one partner, when he or she is down, kind of likes to be left alone for a little while. Then they can enter the zone of communication. Whereas the other partner doesn't want to be left alone. The other partner wants to be kind of talked to or hugged or whatever it would be. Now, if you have a very simple situation like that, and each partner gives the other what they themselves want rather than what their partner needs, you're going to have incredible problems. But it's very, very easy thing to work out just by acknowledging that there are different ways. There are different ways to receive love.
Yeah, but Mike, it comes down to this, and it's what you said. If I don't know, I don't have the choice to bring it about. And I think that's really what the key is. So to have choice, You have to know that there's options out there available. And then once you have
That's correct.
You're good.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And that is really all we have is our choices and the permission to take them. And they will and if we do, they will lead us organically to where we want to be.
No, I completely agree. And I think more and more people today are realizing that a relationship, a relationship could be between two people, it could be a job, it could be with your pet, whatever it is. This is not something that automatically happens. These are learned processes. They are step-by-step-by-step programs to see that that life can come out okay if you take the right steps. That's why I think stage climbing is, that's what it says. This is what you do. You do this, you do this, you do this, and at every level, you begin to learn more about yourself, which opens up, quote unquote, the potential that you didn't think you had.
That's correct. And the strategies are proven ones and ones that have been used by some of the highest achievers throughout history, because none of those people, no matter who they are, the greats throughout history do not have a thing that every single person listening to this show does not have in his or her own way. The only thing they may have done differently was accessed it and took it to wherever it led them.
Yeah.
And that is the secret to reaching your highest potential.
I hear it. Michael, we're just about out of time. Website, we can find you, find the book, and more about what you're doing.
Great. Well, stageclimbing.com, that's just like it's spelled, just like it sounds, one word, stageclimbing.com. You can go there and learn more about the book. In fact, there's a place where you can download the 7 stages and do what I call calibrate an area of your life. You can just kind of take a look at that. And you can also order the book there. You can get the book from Amazon. My own personal website is drmichaelbroder.com. And there I have many, many other books that I've written over the years and a lot of other information for your listeners if they care to visit.
Great. Hey, Mike Broder, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me, and have a wonderful holiday to you and yours.
You too. Good night.
Good night.
Somewhere beyond the sea, she's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on a high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing. It is far beyond the stars, it is near beyond the moon, and I know beyond a doubt, my heart will lead me there soon. We'll meet beyond the shore, we'll kiss just as before. Happy we'll be beyond the sea, and never again I'll go sailing.
the dark, my heart will lead me there soon. We'll meet, I know we'll meet beyond the shore. We're gonna kiss just as before, and happy we'll be beyond the sea.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Elaine Seeler with us, the author of Multidimensional You, Exploring Energetic Evolution and Your Multidimensional Workbook, Exercises for Energetic Awakening. Listen to that word, energetic awakening. A pioneer in the field of transformation energetics, Elaine's worked with the energies of the unseen realms, the vibrations present beyond the five senses. Building on 30 years of experience in career consulting, life planning, holistic health, and sustainable development, she focuses on her energetic work facilitating the transformation and evolution of the planet and all her beings. And let us say, Elaine, I welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. A pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for being a multidimensional you. Most people think they're in this linear world and there's only a piece of them and that's all they have to work with. Obviously, there's more than meets the eye here, isn't there?
Most definitely. My belief is that there is lots going on that we don't see, but that we sense, even though we're not really aware that we're sensing it. So, you know, that wonderful space between you and I, it's filled with energies, and those energies give us information.
Now, by the way, when we talk about energy, this is a question now. Energy comes through vibration, doesn't it?
Correct.
Okay, now, in a prime example of that, if somebody doesn't believe that what you're saying exists, very simple. I see you, and we're in a nightclub, and I walk over and I say, would you like to dance? And it's a slow dance. And all of a sudden, you get caught up with the music. The vibration from the sound of the music has an effect on your body, and you feel completely different. And if that can happen, why can't it happen in every other area of your life?
Well, I think it can, and it does. Yeah. And your example is an interesting one, Michael. The one that I like to give is you're going to dinner at a very good friend's house. You've been there many, many times, and you love going to visit them. This particular evening when you get there, it feels awful. You want to go home. You don't know why. You don't understand why you're not comfortable, because you've always been comfortable in their house before. You manage to get through the evening, and the next morning when you speak to your friend, you discover that she and her husband have just had a terrible argument. And the energy of that anger and resentment or whatever was going on between them, it becomes as real and as palpable as the computer or the microphone that you're holding in your hand. And
sure,
we feel it even though we don't quite understand how.
No question about it. And it's that energy, that, and I'm not a clinician here, but it's that energy that propels us to do what we do. If it's on the dance floor and you feel just, or there, maybe there's your favorite song, the minute it comes up, you can feel an entire change in your body and your emotions and your mind. And it's the same thing as you're saying. You walk into a place, does not feel good. It's, you're experiencing it. And I would imagine, Elaine, that we're actually part of it, because if we weren't part of it, we couldn't feel it.
Well, we are part of it because we also, let's put it this way, everything is made up of vibration. You and I, the radio station, the dance floor, the music on the dance floor. We think of music as vibration and we think of that more easily, but what about the table that you're sitting at or the chair? It's actually also energy, but the energy is going so rapidly that we don't see it move. And we've all agreed that it's solid, even though actually it's moving vibrations.
Yeah.
And that's kind of hard for some people to accept.
Okay, now let me ask you this. Let's take you all the way back. When did this first start with you? When did that light bulb go on for you to realize that there was so much more than what most people see?
It began to happen in the early 90s when I was experiencing things that I tried to explain rationally, but I couldn't. And the linear mind just, you know, the normal everyday explanations just wouldn't work. And so I began to look further. And that's when I looked towards the vibrations and began to understand that I was being affected by people and places energetically, even though I couldn't see those energies.
Now, by the way, it's seeing and feeling are obviously two different things, but it's an experience. It's a feeling. Now, I'm not well versed in this. I know a little bit about it, but it's limited. But at the same time, it's a feeling. It's that something you experience, it's something you feel. You can't quite put a word to it. If you take the word science means it's provable. So this goes beyond science. You don't have to prove it. You know it's there.
Correct. And I believe that in time, we will begin to have scientific proof for it. But right now, we can't prove all of it. There are two very interesting examples, though, for people to look at if they want more visual proof. There's a wonderful book by a Japanese professor by the name of Emoto, and he discovered how to take a flash photograph of water molecules, and they became actual crystals. They're very, very beautiful photographs of water crystals. Are you familiar with this at all?
No.
Okay, well, the book is worth looking at. And the thing that became interesting was that he did experiments, and he would say positive words or prayers or blessings or meditate near particular bodies of water, and the water crystal would change. He could take a picture of very beautiful, clear water, and it would show up as an absolutely beautiful crystal. He would take a picture of polluted water, and it would become an ugly photograph, believe it or not. And then he would bless that water crystal, that body of water, and take another picture. And after the blessing or the statement of positive words, the picture would change. And the photograph of water molecules from that very same source of water would become harmonious, balanced, and very beautiful. Now, so I think in time we are going to see demonstrations, but right now some of us feel it more than others, but everybody's capable of feeling it. And when I say feeling it, I'm talking sense feel. I don't mean feel with your hands.
Sure, sure. And now, by the way, when we're dealing with this, when people are energy workers, quote unquote, is this something that comes naturally to them? Is this something that someone has to study? How does it come about?
I think that it's both. I think for some people it comes very naturally and they discover that they're doing it. I think there are other people who can learn to do it and can learn to be aware that they're doing it. And in my book, I talk a lot about the different ways that people do energy work. And I go through it in quite a bit of detail so that people can begin to become aware of their own pattern of how they might be an energy worker. And I talk about it as awakening the inner energy, your own inner energy worker. I feel we all are capable of it.
Now, by the way, when somebody decides to do this, how do they come by it? When I say that, it's like people who are addicted to drugs and alcohol, et cetera. They have to go all the way down to the bottom before they realize that they need some help someplace. To become an energy worker, to really understand the energetic evolution, as you call it, what does a person have to do? Do they just have to be opened up? Do they have to get smacked in the nose, quote unquote, one day to realize that there's more to life than they think?
I don't know that there's a formulaic response. I think that it can happen any number of ways. Some people might have an extreme experience, a near-death experience, or something of that ilk, and others may just wake up one day and suddenly become aware of things that they were never aware of before. I think right now, possibly people in your audience are listening and thinking, I'm more aware than I was a year ago. I'm actually more aware than I was 2 months ago. And that's part of the evolutionary process that I think is occurring, is it's an awakening. We are waking up to the reality that there is so much more to life than we have thought up to now, that our three-dimensional perception or perspective, which was based strictly on the five senses, is very limited. And what's happening is we are now awakening to a perspective that's much more expansive than that and includes the reality beyond those limited five senses.
Now, by the way, when we're dealing with this, and I think it's important to take a look at, it's not just from person to person. You're talking about something globally. And if the Earth in and of itself has that vibrational that vibrational impact on what's going on, look at what's going on with all of the different countries today. Look at the mindsets. Look at the changes in the dynamic of the way people are thinking now. And I think it's also showing up in what's going on with the planet. I mean, there's more tidal waves, there's more this, there's more that going on. And it's an awakening, and I think it's an awakening that moves through every phase and facet of life. And if you're not aware of it, you're going to get lost in it.
Exactly. No, it is definitely global. It is planetary. It is on every level, in every aspect of our society. One of the most interesting reflections of it is that the Occupy Wall Street movement, which spread from New York all across the globe. And I see that as partially as humanity's awakening to the changes and not quite knowing how to cope with it. So here you have people becoming so disturbed, properly so, but disturbed by what's going on around them that they are gathering and willing to take to the streets. So they're saying, change has to come. We don't understand how we're going to get it, but we're willing to go out and stand up and be counted as wanting it. And the other part of the Occupy Wall Street movement that's really interesting is that it reflects a movement away from individuality towards cooperation and towards unity. We are all one people. We share that vibrational field. What happens to you also affects me and across vast distances, that's true. And so here you have people from one end of the planet to the other who are all similarly reflecting their discontent.
Yeah, and I think
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was going to say the biggest problem with that is I'm going to say, yes, there is a discontent. Yes, there are people that are standing up and saying that things have to change. The problem is the way that it's being done. And I don't think that in any kind of a vibrational realm or world is what the end result should be. You've got, if you really watch what's going on, it's out of control and it's out of whack. And if you ask most of these kids why they're there, they have no idea why they're there. I really believe once it catches, if they would sit down and find out what it is that's catching on to them and then focus in one particular way, that would work. But the way that it's going now, it's basically diluting the original concept of why to do it in the first place.
That may be so. I think that we the mass don't really know how to go about creating the change. I think for me, the important aspect is that traditionally we would view this movement politically or economically or socially. Yeah. And what I'm doing is viewing it energetically.
And I hear it loud and clear. Yeah, by the way, Elaine, I hate to do that. We're just starting to run out of time now. So is there a website where we, and by the way, this had nothing to do with the Wall Street kids. It's just the timing of it. Is there a website we can find you, find the book, find out what you're doing, and buy the book?
Absolutely. The website is multidimensionalyou.com, which is also the name of the book. And if you go on there, you'll learn more about the multidimensional world, more about the books, more about my work. And please, when you go on that website, also sign up to be counted as a multidimensional person, a multidimensional being. And when you go on, you'll understand there's a count up page there that's self-explanatory.
Elaine, hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me. A pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
When I'm gonna wait, you're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if
if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser. If I can say that, Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. George Collins with us. He is an MA. He's the founder and director of Compulsion Solutions. That's an outpatient counseling service in the San Francisco Bay Area, specializing in the treatment of men who suffer from the results of sexually compulsive behavior. Former sex addict himself, he's a professional member of the Society for the Advancement of Sexual Health and is recognized as an expert on sexually compulsive behavior. He's the author of Breaking the Cycle, Free Yourself from Sex Addiction, Porn Obsession, and Shame. George, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. George,
wonderful,
I think
the
real question would be this, to start this with. This, when we talk about sexual addiction, is this something that we hear about and we just don't get that it's as prevalent as it is?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's terrifying, the real statistics. I mean, I sit in this office and get 20 or 30 calls a day just in my office, just from my advertising, from people from all walks of life, Michael. Just amazing. Postmen and people that work in the market and sports celebrities. And it's just rampant.
No, and I hear you loud and clear, and most people just don't get this. Now, is this when somebody has this kind of an addiction, is it genetic? Is it something that is a behavioral problem? What causes this in the first place?
Well, I happen to be a believer that it's nurture, not nature. What that means is that you weren't born as a sex addict, but you learned it. In my particular case, if I can make myself the example, since
Please.
I know myself well enough, I grew up in a home, upper scale, 25 room home with servants, but my parents were alcoholics, and my father beat me senseless, and my mother sexually abused me. I found my father's porn, and because the home was so off balance and so frightening, I found nurturance in the pictures. We in my business, we call that euphoric recall.
Mm-hmm.
So all of us have euphoric recall, Michael. I'm sure that you spent some time at least looking, maybe not, but some time looking at Sears catalog bra ads, or you were fascinated
maybe
by National Geographic.
Maybe was filling them, yeah.
Yeah, but you didn't. And most people don't get hooked up to it and feel like that is my salvation or that's the thing I want to do over and over again. You know, I have a saying, you can't get enough of what won't satisfy you with porn.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And I really believe that I go back to a world. And by the way, let me say this right up front, that I'm a pragmatist. As far as compulsive behavior, et cetera, I've always looked at this in such a way that that can get to the extreme. But I grew up in a world, and I'm going to go back to the 50s now, when during the in the movies, it was Doris Day and so on and so forth, there was a law, and you had to have 1 foot on the floor if there was a bedroom scene. You had none of the language. You had nothing that was going on that goes on normally today. Obviously, yes, yes, there was porn, no question about it. Everybody's going to, men, women alike, there's going to be that time we're going to look at something, get all turned on to a picture or something, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. It's when you go to the extreme.
Well, I understand that, but it's not the case now. Michael, a scary number. I'm getting calls from at least, from kids that are 11 years old.
Sure.
They can barely use the English language coherently and asking me what to do.
Yeah, but look what they're exposed to.
Because they've seen these scenes.
Yeah, but look what they're exposed to. And I think there's where the problem is. You got these 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old kids that you can see anything, anywhere, anytime you want to see it. You go to the you go to cable television. I mean, there's porn on it all the time, and all they say is, well, you have to be 18 years old to see it. So what are they going to do? Look at you when you press the button that you're not 18 years old. So
that's
it's available, and I think that in and of itself is most of the problem that we have here.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's very permissive, and it's a jungle. It's crazy. The Nielsen statistic in 2010 says that 25% of those with internet access view pornography during working hours. 25%, Michael.
That's a lot.
It's an increase from 2007 statistic I read before that.
Is it becoming a the question, I haven't thought about it before, but is it becoming a culture? Is it becoming something that, again, as you're saying, we're seeing more and more of it? Is this becoming more the norm than not?
For sure. You know, when you and I were growing up, it sounds like we're of the same era. In the locker rooms and on the playground, we kind of kidded around about girls' body parts.
Sure.
And then we had some fun doing it, but we still held hands and we still played spin the bottle, and that was pretty risque. Nowadays, anything goes. Kids are emailing back and forth of genital pictures of women and pictures of women with animals.
That's what's going on. Yes. See, and there
I'm sitting in my office looking out at the high school football field in Walnut Creek, California, and I've heard recently that on Craigslist, some of the girls from this local high school have been selling their self for oral sex in between classes.
Yeah. Now, by the way, there is this, I got to tell you, I have no idea how I got on this thing because the it's a one of those dating site things. It's called Fling, F-L-I-N-G, Fling. And I looked at this thing, and somehow I got on this thing, and it's got me as a 29-year-old male, whatever, no pictures. But the most important thing, George, is this: they'll send a thing, and they'll send 12 girls in so-and-so, you know, city in Wisconsin, want to meet men, and they're naked, and it says, if you want to get laid tonight, just pick up the phone. It's guaranteed. Join, you know, it's like the dating service. That is out there, and that is available, and it's not right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, especially to the person, Michael, that's using sex as a coping strategy. You know, you and I grew up in a time when people were we heard about alcoholism, and we knew people who were alcoholics, and we knew about AA, and we knew people that got over it, and then drugs, and then people started talking about workaholics, and now we're talking about sexaholics.
Yes.
And and the problem with sex is that there's the orgasm, and that's the payoff.
Yeah.
And men, you know, we don't get too many women sex addicts because women are more addicted to relationship and love. But the male sex addict is addicted to having an orgasm.
No, and by the way, and the let's go to Penn State right now. You know, look what's coming out. I would say what drives this, George, more than anything else, it's that old follow the money. You know, they're making money through porn films, porn this, porn that. You know, your pay per view, people dumping money into the television to see whatever they're going to see, and so on and so forth. I mean, you can see anything you want to see, but from you know, two men, two women, men, women, yada yada, and you know, and 10 people at one time. But and these kids get exposed to this, so they say, well, it's got to be okay. It's part of the, it's part of what goes on here. They're getting taught sex in early, early ages. Now, again, I'm no, that's what I was going to say before. I'm not a moralist. I'm not. I'm a pragmatist. And when it really comes down to it, this stuff is wrong. It's just, it's not right. And there's people getting hurt from it that shouldn't have to be.
Absolutely. And you know, Michael, you don't have to have a master's degree in psychology to understand that a 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old child doesn't really have a full deck around the emotional parts of sex and intimacy. You know, we weren't taught intimacy in my home, and most homes don't. They don't
George,
teach it.
I was brought
they
up
don't have, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was brought up in the 50s, and I remember this today. I'm what the 11, 12 years old. I'm in the car. It's got to be 1956 or so, and there's like four or five of the guys in the car. We're going someplace. I can't remember where it was, and the guys in the front seat were talking about sex, and they got really explicit, and I remember, I'll never forget this as long as I live. I heard how it worked, and I was 11 years old, and I said, my mom never did that.
Ah, right. Right.
That's the old days.
Yeah, but the old days. Yeah, nowadays, that those days are gone.
Yeah.
But yeah, you were talking about Penn State, and I'm getting a tremendous amount of telephone calls from radio stations that want me to comment on these on this craziness, and I'm having a hard time even commenting on it.
Yeah.
Because I do get pedophiles that call here. You know, it's among other things. Mostly, it's just regular guys that are just doing too much porn. Or doing too many strip clubs or too many prostitutes, and that's sort of the norm nowadays. Mostly porn, though. It's the crack cocaine of sex.
I think that's where the problem lies. It is so available, George. And then again, too, if you put a law against it, you know, you're catching that, you know, your basic freedoms and so on and so forth. So there's a catch-22 here.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be happening, but then again, if you stop it from happening, then you're infringing on the law.
Absolutely. You know, what I did, talking about my book, is that I am a sex addict. I'm recovering, but I'm always watchful. I've developed a system for myself and for people that come to my clinic here, hire a bunch of people. Got people, all the people that have come here have been sex addicts, too. And so I tried to write this book in an interesting way, in a way that was regular guy talk rather than clinical, because the books I read to try and get well years ago were too dry, and I really didn't. I had to use a thesaurus or a dictionary to read them. So.
No question about it. But can there truly be a fix to this?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, all you have to do, Michael, is change your mind. I mean, if you know how to change your mind, and that's not just about sex, it's about anything.
Yeah.
So you can change your mind.
What you're saying is just a shift in the way you think.
Yeah, but you have to have supervision for that, because your mind is a worthy adversary. Your mind doesn't want change. I don't care how terrible it is. Minds don't want to change. And you've been brainwashed, you know, essentially, by your environment. We live in reaction to our history, Mike.
Sure.
We live in reaction to our history. We tie our shoes. We stop for red lights. And if we grew up in an environment where, you know, we thought we needed sex, then we masturbate 5-6 times a day. I mean, I get guys that are calling me that are actually ejaculating blood.
Yeah. Now, by the way, I think this Viagra ad that they've got on television, I think that, and they've sold hundreds of millions of dollars of it. And I think at the very end of that ad is where the sale is, and they know exactly what
I know.
Doing.
What you're going to say too. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. If it lasts more than 4 hours, go see your doctor. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and everybody applauds and says, "Boy, if it lasts more than 4 hours, I'd be happy."
Yeah, it's the bragging rights, but that's really the key. They know how to hook you in. They know exactly what to say to get you to do what they want you to do.
Well, let me tell you, Michael, and you know this as well as I do. The media is the message, and Madison Avenue knows that sex sells. I get, not so much anymore because I think I'm off the list, but I used to get calls from people that would manufacture things or vendors who would sell food products. I won't mention any names, but they would pay me $1,200 an hour to tell them to have me review their videos of the ads they're going to run and tell them when the point of, they call it the point of white heat, when that would arrive, because they wanted the client who was watching a hamburger commercial to buy a, to make sure that he bought a hamburger. They would put a woman in and have her half dressed and dripping mustard or ketchup on her chest, and these are the kind of ads that, that were so provocative. And but they would hire psychologists.
Oh, absolutely. By the way, they're also called somatic markers, those emotional triggers that, that cause the buying response. And the quick example of it is the Nutrisystem commercial. You got a woman on the left-hand side of the screen that's 100 pounds overweight, same woman, and she's, by the way, she's looking very depressed and sullen. Same woman on the right-hand side of the screen, happy, everything is good. In that moment, that hot spot moment of, oh, I can fix it with that. That's the same thing that happens with those point of white heat you're talking about. And I've said it time and again, if anybody wants to really pay attention to this, watch the commercials on television. What you will see right about the time they hit to that point you're talking about, a woman with a great rear end will walk by the screen.
Uh-huh.
Start watching. You'll see it. But you got to know it's there. I know.
Well, what
you can't,
we do here, what we do here, Michael, is have people call in. Most of our work is Skype and telephone. We work with people all over the country and Canada and all over the world, really. And we do phone work, make it painless and simple. And people have homework; they have to do their homework, or they don't. They can't. They're not. They can't stay with us, and they can call us during the week. We're a lot different than traditional therapists because we know that they're going to get hit during the week. They're going to get triggered. So what we try to do is make sure that they don't do it.
Well, by the way, we're starting to run out of time now, George. Now, website we can find you at?
You can go to my website, compulsionsolutions.com, and it's 925-932-0201. We welcome telephone calls. Everything is held in strict confidence. We're more than happy to whoever answers the phone is skilled in this profession and has suffered the same thing. So what we're trying to do is help, and it doesn't cost a thing to call the first time. We're here to help you. We'll recommend things. We'll recommend our books. We'll recommend groups. We'll all kinds of things. So we're here for the people.
Great. Hey, George Collins, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time, and you guys are doing a heck of a job out there.
Thank you very much. Great to talk to you.
Take care. Good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Dusty world. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new.